is Matthew is overlaying a he's creating an overlaid message onto what he has literally written. He's created a symbolic message on there as well that only a Jewish reader is going to understand. The number 14 wouldn't mean anything to a Greek or Gentile reader, but the number 14 would be very important to a Jewish reader. They would automatically attach significance to that. Just as us, when we read the Bible, we understand the number 7 and 12 talk about are referring to completion and perfection and so on. So we see the number 7 and 12 and it jumps out at us. In the same way, the number 14 would have jumped out at a Jewish reader there who would associate that with King David because of the numerical value of his name. So it's just an overlaid symbolic meaning that is laid over that. Yes, Nathan.
Overall, it's not the fact that it's not 14 generations because, like you said, it's just
it's an artificial construct
the
there.
Numeric code. That's
right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. I might mention also, too, if you go back to Goliath and the 666, actually in our English Bibles, it has the number 6 and 5 and 6. That's apparently a textual error in there. Some of the earlier Hebrew manuscripts have 6, 6, and 6, and somewhere along the way that got changed to a 5 in there. So yeah, again, a Jewish reader reading about Goliath is going to know that 666 means this dude is bad. He's Satan's agent. He's Satan's representative. And who kills the representative of Satan? David. David, the king, number 14. So cool stuff there. So, okay, now let's pick it up, continue with the story of the announcement of the coming birth of John the Baptist. And there is also something really cool in here. That we're going to get to, assuming I have time. Let's launch into this, starting in Luke 1 and verse 5. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, this is talking about Herod the Great, whom we've talked about yesterday, the same Herod who is the great builder who built this magnificent temple in Jerusalem. Here's a computer-generated view of the temple here in the background, these vast courtyards. And it was surrounded on four sides by these colonnades. They're referred to as the porch sometimes in Scripture in the book of Acts or the Gospels. It's a shaded area. Jerusalem's pretty warm climate much of the year, so it had these 70-foot-tall columns that were shaded over so the people could stay out of the shade. This whole complex covers about 35 acres there, so vast, vast temple complex could accommodate a million or more people there. And so this kind of helps us get an idea of what this is like. So there was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zechariah. I'll call him Zechariah, which is what his name would have been in Hebrew. Instead of Zacharias, the Greek translation of that. The Bible doesn't tell us anything about the parents of Zechariah, but it's interesting that they chose this name for him, getting back to what we talked about earlier. They would name their children after famous people from Israelite history. And names had meaning then, as opposed to our names today. We give names. Your parents named you and probably didn't give a whole lot of thought to their name. My name literally means a tattooed wild man who lives in an ash tree meadow. So I hope my parents didn't have anything in particular when they named me that, but that's what it means. So it's interesting that they, put that in your notes, tattooed wild man who lives in an ash tree meadow. So, and no, I don't have any tattoos, so. My wife has accused me of being a wild man, though. So the Jewish parents at that time did choose names for their children that were intended to convey the child's destiny or their hopes and dreams for what their child would become. And they named their child Zechariah, which means remembered by God. Remembered by God is what the name Zechariah means. Now, why would they choose that name? Well, we're talking about a period, this several hundred years between the ending of the Old Testament with Malachi and the beginning of the New Testament. There's several hundred years in there in which God doesn't show up. God doesn't seem to be working with his people. They have lost their independence. The northern 10 tribes are carried away into Assyria. The kingdom of Judah is defeated, taken away into captivity into Babylon. Some of the Jews return under Ezra and Nehemiah and rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. But the period of miracles and prophets is over. And people are thinking, where is God gone? Where are the promises of a Messiah? When are we going to gain our freedom? Because they've been under the domination of the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks and now the Romans. And when are we going to be a free people again? When is God going to remember us and answer our prayers? And maybe this is why Zechariah's parents named him Zechariah, remembered by God, that they are possibly expressing this hope that God will not permanently forget his people, as has happened for several centuries there. Again, trying to help you understand the mindset of the people and what is going on in their thinking at that time. Did they name their son Zechariah, remembered by God, because this is what they were wishing and hoping for, that they would be a people remembered by God, and he would intervene and bring the Messiah and throw off the Romans and so on. So that's quite possible. I think that's highly probable, again, just thinking of their mindset at that time. But at the very least, Zechariah would, the name would remind people of the great prophet Zechariah, one of the minor prophets there. The prophet Zechariah, who was the namesake. Continuing here in verse 5, we see that he was on the division of Abijah, or Abiah in Hebrew. What is this talking about? Write down in your notes 1 Chronicles 24, 3 through 19. We won't read all of this. But this is talking about near the end of King David's life. David is not going to be allowed to build the temple of God because he was a man of war. He was a bloody man. And the temple would be built by Solomon after David's death. But David is setting things in order, preparing things for the temple, gathering construction material and so on. And he's faced with a rather interesting situation, as we see here. Then David, with Zadok of the sons of Eleazar and Ahimelech of the sons of Ithamar, divided them, the divisions of the descendants of Aaron, who were the priests, according to the schedule of their service. Thus they were divided by lot, and the seventh lot fell to Hakaz, the eighth to Abiah. To summarize what's going on here, is there are far too many priests to serve at one time in the temple. The temple is just going to be too small because there's thousands and thousands of priests, and they can't all serve at once. Otherwise, they're literally tripping over each other, running into each other there. So what David does is he divides the priests into 24 groups by their families, by their clans. And these 24 groups will rotate. Group 1 serves 1 week. Group 2 serves the next week. Group 3 serves the next week, and so on, through the 24 weeks. And they choose the weeks by lot, as it says here. Now, all of the priests came in to serve 3 times a year, at Passover in the Days of Unleavened Bread, and at Pentecost, and at Feast of Tabernacles in the 8th day. All the priests did come in at those times because there's so many sacrifices to be done, so many things to be done at the temple in connection with those holy day seasons. But the normal weeks of the year that aren't the holy day seasons, only 1/24th of the priests come in and serve in those weeks by rotation. So every group of priests is going to serve their 1 week of rotation, then 24 weeks later, they'll serve their second week. And interspersed in there are Passover season, Pentecost, and Feast of Tabernacles, so when everybody comes in. Now, it's also a common misconception. We tend to think that all of the priests lived at Jerusalem or in Jerusalem. That's not so. Most of the priests lived outside in the outlying towns around Jerusalem, and they had their own farms and property and businesses and things like that. And this is the case with Zechariah and his wife as well. They lived somewhere outside of Jerusalem. So that's a common misunderstanding. Yes, there was a permanent priestly aristocracy. We talked about the Sadducees. I was rushing through that at the end of yesterday's talk, but they were the ones who administered and controlled the businesses of the temple. We'll touch on that a little bit later when Jesus overturns the money changers. But the Sadducees had turned the priesthood and the temple into a giant money-making opportunity for themselves, and they're getting rich off this. This comes later, 30 years later, when Jesus begins his ministry. So this is the schedule, and what is significant about this is it gives us a time to calculate the birth of Jesus Christ, which is not on December 25th. So the schedule, the rotating schedule, started the week after the Feast of Tabernacles. So that was week one. So it'd go through 24 weeks, interspersed with the other holy days, then the cycle would start over again. So it'd start after the Feast of Tabernacles and roughly after the spring holy days, depending on exactly when they fell. So the timing that we have based on this course of Abia in which Zechariah is serving as a priest in the temple is this. So it would be good to write this down in your notes. So Zechariah, he served in a course that started in early December and mid-June. And this is spelled out in the Companion Bible. I believe there's a copy of it in the library if you want to look it up. It's Appendix 179. It's pretty dry reading, so I didn't bother to print it off and pass it out to you. But you can look it up there, the reference for this. So his course of priests, it's the rotation or the course, as it's called, served in early December and mid-June. Again, interspersing with the holy days in there. So Elizabeth then likely conceives in late June. You can read about that in Luke 1, 23 and 24. 9 months later brings us to late March for the birth of John the Baptizer. And again, I call him the Baptizer, not the Baptist. He's not of the Baptist denomination. His job is baptizing. John the Immerser is another term you could use for it. And since John is 6 months younger than, or older than Jesus, 6 months after late March leads us to late September for the birth of Jesus Christ, not in the middle of winter in December. Okay, so continuing back in Luke 1 and verse 5, Luke 1 and verse 5, there was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zechariah of the division of Abia. His wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth, or in Hebrew, Elisheva, which means oath of God. So he is married. His wife is also of a priestly family. So double priest. He's of the priestly tribe. So is his wife, Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, verse 6, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord blameless. So Luke tells us here they are both righteous, blameless, God lovers. They obey God. They love God's way of life. They obey him from the heart, not just going through the motions, pretending that they're righteous. And again, you might contrast his righteousness, his and his wife's walking with God, compared to the priests that Jesus will confront later who conspire to kill him. The priesthood is becoming progressively more corrupted at that time. And Jesus actually calls them later a bunch of snakes and hypocrites. They were so corrupt in their actions and attitudes. So Zechariah stands in stark contrast to the priests that Jesus will later encounter. And then Luke introduces something that, again, is utterly shocking in the culture of that day. In verse 7, he says, "But they had no child because Elizabeth was barren, and they were both well advanced in years." Now, this is just mentioned in passing by Luke, but there is a load of meaning in those verses there, or that one verse here. In the culture of that day, this just did not add up. Why is that? Well, because if you were righteous, obviously you would be blessed with a lot of children, as people viewed it in that day. You might think of the psalm, "Happy is he whose quivers bear a full store of arrows such as these." Blessed is the couple who have a quiver full of arrows, a lot of children there. Children were a blessing, viewed as a great blessing of God. And what is the first commandment given in the Bible? Anybody? Be fruitful and multiply. Good, good. way to be awake here. Be fruitful and multiply. That was the first commandment, and the Jewish people of that day took it very literally. They still take it very literally today there in Israel among the Orthodox Jews. So they'll have families of 8, 10, 12 children here. So be fruitful and multiply. So that was a command. And we see people with large families there. As we mentioned Jesus earlier, he has 4 brothers and at least 2 sisters. So there's at least 7 children in that family. If you were a good Jewish man and woman, you would have lots of children. You're fulfilling God's command to be fruitful and multiply. And if you weren't doing that, and you weren't blessed with a lot of children, then in the common viewpoint of the day, then you were probably engaged in some kind of secret sin. Or God is cursing you by not giving you children. Now, in the case of Zechariah and Elizabeth here, they had been married years before this, and they obviously expected to have a lot of children. After all, they're from 2 priestly families, so obviously God is going to bless them, and their children are going to grow up and be part of the priesthood as well, and maybe their daughters will also marry a priestly family and so on. And now decades have passed, and they have no children. And that is a great embarrassment and a great shame to them. That would be bad enough for anyone, but for a husband who's a priest and for a wife who's part of a priestly family, people would naturally assume that they are sinning and they're being cursed by God for some reason by not being able to bear children. But over these decades, they're going to keep praying for a son or a daughter to carry on the family name, and they don't give up hope. And they wait, and they wait, and they wait, and they wait longer. And how do they wait? Well, as it says here, they wait walking in all the commandments and ordinances of God. They wait in faith. They wait in obedience. They don't give up on God. They obey him. They are faithful. They are righteous people. But it is a severe trial for them, for a priest and his wife, to go through all those years without any children, but they don't let that get in the way of their relationship with God. But finally, it reaches a point where it's obvious that their childbearing days are over. And Elizabeth is too old to have children, and Zechariah is probably too old to father children. As it says here, they were both well advanced in years. So their time for bearing a son to carry on the family name is over. It doesn't say exactly how old they are, just based on the language. They're probably at least in their 60s, maybe 70s, maybe 80s, to be well advanced in years. It indicates they're well past the time of bearing children. So that's the background for this story. That kind of sets the stage. This is what Luke doesn't spell out for us. But you've got Zechariah and Elizabeth who have lived with a lot of shame for not being able to bear children for years. and they're looked down on by the community because they're obviously sinning and God is cursing them. And that's why they're not bearing children. And you might think of some other couples like that, Abraham and Sarah, same type of situation. And finally, God intervenes. And Sarah is able to bear a child. You might think of Hannah, the mother of Samuel, as well. So it's not a total, that's in 1 Samuel 1, if you want to write that down. So there are other precedents like this where women are not able to bear children and God finally does intervene for them. So there's a lot of information packed into this little bitty section here. And it's a heartbreaking story. Heartbreaking for them. And that makes the ending all the more wonderful. Continuing on, verse 8. So it was that while he was serving as priest before God in the order of his division, the course of Abiah, the eighth course, according to the custom of the priesthood, his lot fell to burn incense when he went into the temple of the Lord. And the whole multitude of the people was praying outside at the hour of incense. Now let's talk about the temple for a bit and get a better idea of what's going on and why this is so special to Zechariah and such a profound event for him. It says here, his lot fell to burn incense when he went into the temple of the Lord. So here's an overview, computer-generated graphic of Jerusalem at that period, around 30-31 AD. So here's the city of Jerusalem out here, surrounded by a wall. Here's this giant 35-36-acre complex that we saw earlier. Here's the temple itself right in the middle. And I should mention temple can have a range of meanings in the New Testament. Strictly speaking, just this one building here is the temple, but temple is also used in a generic sense to refer just to this or to this entire huge, enormous complex with all the courts and so on. So strictly speaking, that is the temple, and only priests were allowed inside the temple itself. Other people could go in there's a court of the Gentiles where Gentiles are allowed out here and over here. And then there's a little wall here where past which Gentiles are not allowed to go. And then there's the court of women where the women are allowed. And finally the temple itself where only the priests are allowed. And within it, the Holy of Holies where only the high priest is allowed to go. So this is again, a huge structure. This is kind of viewed aerially from above the Mount of Olives. Here's the Kidron Valley down here, a bridge or causeway that goes across it to the Mount of Olives. So you're elevated here about a half a mile high looking down on Jerusalem. Incidentally, to give you some idea of the scale of this, this temple is about 15 stories high. 15 stories high, so I don't know what the biggest building in Cincinnati would be. I'd guess somewhere around 25, 30 stories. 34? Okay, so this is going to be about half the height of the tallest building in Cincinnati, kind of give you a sense of scale. So huge complex there. And again, on the holy days, there would be literally hundreds of thousands, maybe a million or more people who would assemble here at the temple. That's what's happening in Pentecost when the church is founded, for instance. So this kind of sets the stage for it here. It gives you an idea of the size of this. Here's another view of looking more close-up view of the temple. See the height of it, see the scale of some of the priests down here before the gates, going into the courtyard. Here's the altar with the fire burning on it. The animals would have been sacrificed there. So again, just a huge, huge building. Now let's step inside to where what we'll read about next takes place. This is the inner part of the, called the holy place. There's a holy place where only priests are allowed to go, and then behind this giant curtain at the back is the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was, and that was viewed as the place where God dwells. on the mercy seat, on the Ark of the Covenant there. So here's the menorah, sometimes referred to as a candlestick in the Bible, which is a horrible translation. It's talking about the menorah, the seven-branch menorah made out of solid gold. Here's the incense altar, where there would be hot coals burning, and the priests would put incense on that, representing the prayers of the saints ascending up through a little hole in the top of the temple. Over here is the table of the showbread there within that, and much of the interior of this is covered with gold decorations, expensive woods, just a fabulously beautiful place. Now, I will say one thing is off about this picture, and that is that when Zechariah went in to offer incense, he is the only one in there. No other priest is in there at that time. So Zechariah would have gone to offer incense on this altar. He would have been alone, and he would have been facing the Holy of Holies. So the incense altar, just to kind of give us a sense of scale, let's say this curtain back here behind the stage is this curtain that covers the Holy of Holies behind there. And this incense altar would have stood a few feet out in front of it. Let's say it's where this lectern is, about that far from the Holy of Holies. And as far as the priests were concerned, what was behind that curtain? God is behind that curtain, because that's where the mercy seat is, on top of the Ark of the Covenant. The mercy seat where God dwells between the cherubim. So again, you need to understand their mindset, their thinking of that day. So Zechariah would have come in and offered the incense representing the prayers of God's people on the hot coals. And there was the incense, the smoke would have gone up and out a small opening in the roof of the temple there. Now, by the time Jesus came on the scene, the number of priests numbered somewhere between 20 and 25,000 based on our best guess, 20 to 25,000 priests. This is why they couldn't all serve at one time. It's just way too many of them here. And you kind of get a flavor of that by this illustration, showing the priests, and of course some of them are singing, some are playing instruments as part of the worship of God, and this sort of thing. So if you do the math, you divide, and let's round it off to 24,000 priests, and there are 24 courses of priests, that means there are 1,000 priests in each course. This is just round numbers to help us get a handle on that. So if you do the math, there are 1,000 priests in your course. And of course, some are retiring and some are coming on when they reach age 30 each year. So there were four particular jobs in the temple every day that were drawn by lot. As we just read, the lot fell on him to burn incense. The lot fell on Zechariah to burn incense. And so the odds of that happening, you've got 1,000 priests and four per day. So in 7 days, you have 28 of them who will be drawn by lot to do these four special jobs over the course of your week, or 14 a year. But you do the math, and it comes out to basically, if you're lucky, you're going to get to do that once in your lifetime, just by doing the math. Many of the priests would never be drawn to offer the incense. As a matter of fact, they had a rule that if you did offer the incense once, you were never allowed to do it again over the course of your lifetime, just to spread the opportunity around. It wasn't viewed as fair for you to be able to do it, and other priests go through their entire lifetime and never have the opportunity to offer the incense. So most priests probably didn't. Yes, Stephen. Yeah.
I might have missed this. You said it, but did they do this lot every day?
It seems to have been done daily. I'd have to go back and read the sources, but I think it was done daily. There were, and I don't remember what the four specific jobs were, but there were four. And this information is drawn from the Mishnah. I might say the Mishnah. Have you talked about the Mishnah? Okay, the Mishnah is Let's see. We talked yesterday about the Gospels being written and the circumstances for them being written and how they didn't see a need to write the Gospel story down in the early days. But a similar situation happens with the Mishnah. The temple is destroyed in 70 A.D., and the Jewish priests, the temple is destroyed, and the people are scattered, and they see a need to write down the important information. So between about the year 100 and 200 A.D., they write down what you might call an encyclopedia of religious information and practices and so on. For the Jewish religion as it was practiced for the previous century or two, which would include the first century. So the Mishnah dates to about 200 AD, but it's recording information for what had been practiced for decades, maybe two centuries back to the time period of Jesus and the apostles. So it's the best information we have from Jewish practice, and a fair amount of the information I'm giving you is being drawn from the writings that are preserved in the Mishnah, the Talmud, other Jewish writings like that. So this year, getting back to the story flow now, with that little bit of background where the source information is coming from. So this year, the course of Abiah is serving, and Zechariah goes into the temple and gets chosen by lot to offer the incense on the altar, which was the most honored thing to do. Again, if you got drawn once, you can never do it again. So the choice falls on this old man, this old priest, Zechariah, who's never done it before. So think about, let's put ourselves in Zechariah's sandals for a minute here. He's an old man, my guess, probably around age 70 or 80 by this time, well advanced in years, as we read. It's been his entire life in service to God as a priest, and years had passed by, and he never gets chosen, and decades have passed by, and he never gets chosen. And by this point, considering his age, he's probably doubting that he'll ever get chosen for this great honor of offering incense, representing the prayers of all of God's people to the temple. And meanwhile, also for years, he's heard the whispering about himself and his wife Elizabeth not being able to bear children, and they're not able to have children because they're engaged in some secret sin. I wonder what it is. And this kind of thing. So he's put up with this for years of his life. And now, finally, he gets chosen for doing this. And the people are gathered outside the temple as the incense is going to be offered, which takes place at the time of the morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice, which is 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. roughly. So Zechariah takes his bowl of incense and he goes into the temple to offer this. And this has to be the highlight of his lifetime as a priest, because he is never and never will again get that close to the Holy of Holies, where God dwells, behind the curtain of the Holy of Holies. And he's all alone and separated only by a few yards in this thick, heavy curtain. It's described as being a hand breadth in thickness. So I'm not sure if that's talking about the width of the hand or the fingers extended, but somewhere between 4 and 8 inches or so, the thickness of this curtain behind which God dwells in the Holy of Holies. And he walks up to the altar of incense with his bowl of incense, and maybe with hands trembling a little bit with age and a little bit realizing the sobering offering that he's about to present to God, and it begins a prayer. And the Mishnah records the prayer that was given with the offering of incense. What did he pray? Did he pray one last time for a son? Because thinking, hey, I'm as close to God as I will ever be. God is right behind that curtain. Does he think, one more time, I'll pray for a son? We don't know, but we do know from what is recorded in the Mishnah, the prayer that was supposed to be offered with the offering of the incense. And we can't say 100% for sure that this is word for word correct, but considering how meticulously they recorded everything else in the Mishnah, it has to be very close to this. So picture Zechariah coming with his old man, whispered about people thinking he's cursed for not being able to bear children. And he comes and he pours the incense and he starts praying. And in his prayer, according to the Mishnah, is this line. Send us the one who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. Send us the one who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. And as this elderly priest offers the incense and prays, send us the one who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord, he becomes aware that he's not alone, that there's another presence in the room there with him, that an angel is there with him. Continuing the story in verse 11, that an angel of the Lord appeared to Zechariah standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And when Zechariah saw him, he was troubled and fear fell upon him. And what this means is, to be blunt, he is scared stiff. Because he's supposed to be alone, and suddenly an angel appears there before him. And we know he's scared stiff because what are the first words of the angel to him? Do not be afraid, Zechariah. He's obviously scared spitless there. For your prayer is heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you shall call his name John. Did Zechariah pray for a son? I think he probably did, because otherwise, why would the angel say, your prayer is heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you shall call his name John? So here is a profound answer to prayer. Miraculous answer to prayer, because he and his wife are on up there in years, 60, 70, 80 years old maybe. And the angel's message is a direct response to the prayer of Zechariah that we just read, send us the one who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. And the angel tells Zechariah that he is to name his son John, Yochanan in Hebrew, which means God is a gracious giver. God is a gracious giver. So think about that. The angel tells Zechariah that God is about to give Zechariah the gift that he has waited for decades of his adult life, him and his wife. And he tells Zechariah to name his son, God is a gracious giver. So that every time Zechariah calls his son Yochanan by his name, Zechariah will be reminded, God is a gracious giver. And every time Yochanan, John the Baptizer, hears his name, he will be reminded, God is a gracious giver. And God is indeed a gracious giver. And that this birth, he will be reminded, Zechariah will be reminded, and John, Yochanan, will be reminded that God is a gracious giver. And he has miraculously answered the prayers of Zechariah, whose name means God remembers. God remembers. Now, I don't know how that strikes you, but to me, I can't give this without almost breaking down. It is so incredibly powerful when we understand the context of what is going on here. You know, I talked about yesterday about the Pax Romana and the verse from Galatians 4, when the fullness of time had come, and how there was only this window of time there in the first part of the first century when conditions were right for the coming of the Messiah and the founding of the church. And so the word of the gospel, the good news, could spread through the Roman world, because before that time, for centuries, there was nothing but chaos and war and pirates and robbers and all of that. and for centuries after that, on up to today, that whole region is engulfed in what? War, turmoil, upset, things like that. So God does things according to a perfect timetable, a perfect timetable. And when we look at the context and we understand the system and the timing that had been set up by King David 1,000 years earlier, when he set up the courses of the priests and the timing at which they would come to make this particular announcement to this particular elderly priest about the coming of the one who would prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. And that Zechariah would pray, send us the one who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. And the angel shows up and tells him, your prayers have been answered. You're going to bear the son who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. And this is all part of a system God had set up 1,000 years before. Does that not tell us something incredible about the thinking and the planning and the perfection of the thinking of our God? I mean, to me, that just blows away. It shows that God is always faithful, that he does always remember and do what he promises. And what does Zechariah mean? Remembered by God. Remembered by God. Continuing with the story, verse 14. And the angel says to Zechariah, and you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. For he will be great in the sight of the Lord, and shall drink neither wine nor strong drink. He will also be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. He will also go before him in the spirit and the power of Elijah. And here we see an incredible continuity between the last books of the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, and the beginning of the New Testament books here. What was the last book of the Hebrew Scriptures? It's Malachi. How does the book of Malachi end? Malachi 3, verse 1. Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight. Behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. And also Malachi 4, verses 5 and 6. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse. So John the baptizer, Yochanan, is the one who came to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children. And continuing in Luke 1 and verse 17, as we just read, he will also go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, as we just read there in Malachi, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. So John would come, Yochanan, the baptizer, would come to prepare the way for Jesus, the Messiah, by telling people that one greater than him was coming, and to urge them to repent and be ready for the coming of the Lord, the coming of Messiah, for the coming of the I Am, as we talked about in the first lecture. Verse 18, to wrap this up quickly, and Zechariah said to the angel, how shall I know this? For I am an old man, and my wife is well advanced in years. So Zechariah understandably blurts out the first thing that comes to his mind, which is, I appreciate this promise, but look, I'm an old man and my wife is an old woman. We're like 70, 80 years old. How can we have a son? How is that even possible? Verse 19, and the angel answered and said, I am Gabriel. And for a priest, that had to certainly get his attention because he obviously knew who Gabriel was. There are three archangels mentioned. In the Hebrew Scriptures, there is Gabriel, Michael, and Hillel, commonly known as Lucifer. Lucifer is a Latin translation of Hillel. What is the role of Gabriel? He is the messenger. He is the archangel who brings messages. He's the one who reveals God's word about the future, as we see from the book of Daniel, where he appears to Daniel. And he says, I am Gabriel, which means warrior of God or man of God, who stands in the presence of God and was sent to speak to you until the day these things to speak to you and bring you these glad tidings. But behold, you will be mute and not able to speak until the day these things take place, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their own time. And I'll mention here that this word mute can mean mute, or can mean mute and deaf as well, or perhaps both, depending on the context. And Zechariah is apparently made deaf as well, because down in verse 62, we read a little bit later that they made signs to Zechariah what he would have him called. Why would they make signs that would indicate Zechariah is also deaf? He's not just mute, cannot speak, but also cannot hear until the birth of his son. Now, this may sound a little bit harsh for Zechariah to be made mute and deaf for not believing Gabriel's message, but let's think this through for just a minute. Zechariah and Elizabeth are an elderly couple, and he's just been told he's going to have a son in his old age, which for somebody in his 70s, maybe 80s, that's going to be pretty stressful. But not just any son. His son is going to be the one who is going to prepare the way for the coming of the Lord, the coming of the Messiah. So a miracle is about to take place. They're going to have a son, and not just any son. So Zechariah is going to have 9 months to think it over. And what are some of the questions that are going to be going through his mind? I'm going to have a son. He's going to prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. What am I going to teach him? How am I going to rear him? How am I going to bring him up? So this may have been God's way of actually doing Zechariah a favor of removing the distractions and letting him focus on how radically and dramatically and powerfully his life is about to change here, and bringing up the son who's going to prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah. You're going to need months just to mentally prepare yourself and process that. And I think God kind of gives Zechariah a time out. Okay, let's remove the distractions. Let's focus on the next phase of your life. And that's what's going to happen here. And meanwhile, outside the temple, continuing the story, verse 21, outside the temple, the people are wondering what's taking Zechariah so long here. The people waited for Zechariah and marveled that he lingered so long in the temple. But when he came out, he could not speak to them, and they perceived that he had seen a vision in the temple. For he beckoned to them and remained speechless. Maybe he's saying, I can't speak, I can't hear you either. So he could not speak, and he remained speechless, but he was gesturing to convey to them, you know, I was offering the incense, and an angel stood there, big wings, you know, those things. And it's got to be an incredible sight to witness there, how he's trying to explain to them what's going on, and he can't speak and tell people about it. So just it's a little bit humorous to think about that. Verse 22, they perceived he had seen a vision in the temple, for he beckoned to them and remained speechless. Verse 23, and so it was, as soon as the days of his service, the week, the course of Abiah, were completed, that he departed to his own house. And again, he's part of the priests that don't live in Jerusalem. He returns back to his town, wherever that is. So to wrap this up then, we have this woman who has been looked down on for so long, for decades, for being unable to bear children, who's been whispered about, who people think is being punished for some secret sin, and she's being cursed for not being able, and that's why she can't bear children. And finally, Zechariah and Elizabeth are vindicated, and she is to give birth to one who is foretold in a number of ancient prophecies. And she is now considered honorable, the one whose son would become a great prophet in an astounding way. Let's see, verse 24, I forgot to read that. Now, after these days, his wife Elizabeth conceived, and she hid herself 5 months, saying, thus the Lord has dealt with me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach among people. So this woman has been looked down on. She knows, she feels her reproach, her shame at not being able to bear children. Why does she hide herself away for 5 months? It doesn't say, but perhaps she didn't, considering her advanced age, she didn't want to take a risk of losing the baby. Or maybe it's kind of like Zechariah. She's got to have 5 months to process this dramatic change that's about to happen in her life, that they would have a son who would prepare the way for the coming of Jesus, the Messiah. So this is a story that's easy to read over, to gloss over, to not pick up on a fraction of what's going on there. But when we understand the culture, there's just whole new levels of meaning and story and understanding about the greatness of God that is there within the Gospels for us.